It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check in with Harry Enten of 538 to get the latest in national politics.
First, Wisconsin is now joining 21 other states in suing the U.S. Department of Labor over a rule that would expand the number of people eligible for overtime pay. The rule was announced in May, and it's set to take effect in December. It more than doubles the salary level for employees to be eligible for overtime, raising it from $23,000 to $47,500.
J. Michael Collins is with us now to explain how this rule could affect workers. He's the faculty director for the Center for Financial Security at UW-Madison. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the expansion of this overtime rule. How would this affect workers?
Well, the main effect would be that there are workers who previously were exempt and would work overtime but not be compensated for it. Now they're going to be required by this new regulation to be compensated. So people who previously weren't being paid overtime will be paid overtime now if they exceed the 40 hours per week.
And so this is saying, we talked briefly about the increase in the salary level where overtime kicks in, but you're saying that there's a whole class of workers who never were eligible for overtime pay that would be now.
Right. I mean, when the overtime rules were put into place some 30 years ago, the idea was that we wanted to provide some protections for workers so that they could be compensated for those extra hours they work, especially when those exceed the 40 hours a week level. And at that time, the Department of Labor and the Congress set a level at which salaries would be based on, which is around that $23,000 level. And it just never grew with inflation. It was never indexed over time and never sort of kept up as prices and salaries rose. So in some ways, this is just going back to what the standards were 30 years ago and trying to make them sort of comparable today.
And how do you see this law going into effect impacting employers? What kind of changes are they likely to have to make?
Well, employers are sort of all over the place in how they're responding to this. And some are, they were already being pretty attentive to the hours and compensation of their employees, and so it's not a big deal. Others, it's a pretty big shock, and so the implementation timeline on this has been a struggle for them, and that's what we've seen a number of lawsuits and other actions taking place. I mean, their main reactions are they can limit employees so that they simply don't work more than the 40 hours a week. They don't go into that overline status. They can raise their salaries so that the employee salaries are above that $47,500 limit, and then those people are not entitled to overtime anymore. Of course, they can also respond in terms of their staffing level. So they might decide, okay, we're just not going to have as many employees. We're going to change the structure of our how we implement our staff, and that's a concern because we obviously don't want to see people who are harmed from new regulations like this.
Well, and I could also see a possible unintended consequence being that they might hire more people, but bring those people in at halftime or maybe three-quarters time, so there would be some wiggle room to have them work over what their usual hours are, but still not be bumping up against that 40-hour-a-week ceiling.
Right. No, other options they might have would be, okay, we're going to go ahead, and when we do need overtime from you, we'll pay you the time and a half or whatever our overtime arrangement is, but then, as a way to sort of help pay for this, we're going to reduce benefits, or we're not going to have as much support for your retirement plan or other kinds of unintended consequences. So, we do worry about those reactions by employers as well.
We're talking with J. Michael Collins. He's faculty director for the Center for Financial Security at UW-Madison. We're talking about the fact that Wisconsin just joined 21 other states in suing the U.S. Department of Labor over a change in the overtime pay law. And, Michael, it seems like this will have some kind of an impact on the job market. What are you anticipating will be that result for people who might be either looking to change jobs or looking for work maybe for the first time?
Well, I think that the main impact is going to be that there were probably a lot of jobs out there that people never considered having an overtime possibility. Maybe they were in that $30,000 to $40,000 range, and now some of those positions would have the potential of having overtime. Now, for some employees, that's seen as a benefit. They like the idea that if they work over that 40 hours, they might be able to, each additional hour makes them a lot more. On the other hand, there might be fewer of those jobs offered because employers will be sensitive to the fact that now those positions might have this additional cost, and so they either won't offer as many of those jobs, or they will, as you mentioned earlier, they'll keep the hours well below that 40 hours per week. I think there is some flexibility for employers in how they implement this, and for every employee, it's important to understand what your company or what your potential employer's policies are, and how they're going to treat overtime, whether that's requested overtime or unrequested overtime, and just fully understanding what's going to happen. We have seen certainly some employee groups begin to conflict with their employer over how these rules are interpreted, and that's resulted in some legal actions as well.
So why now? Why is this big increase? And to a non-economist, a jump from $23,000 salary to $47,500 as the threshold and adding in different categories of people who would count for overtime, that all seems like a big change and a pretty significant change. Why now? What's the impetus for this?
Well, 30 years ago, nearly half of workers were covered by this provision, and today it's down to, less than 10%. So what's happened is that the law didn't keep up with inflation. It didn't change over time. And so part of the change that's put into place is that not only will it increase from $23,000 to $47,000, but it's going to be indexed for inflation. So it's going to continue to rise over time and keep up with inflation better. So you won't have these really, the massive jumps like we're seeing right now. The problem is that this jump is massive, as you said, and so this is hard. We're talking about millions of employees who were not affected, who are now affected. And that's hard for employees, and it's hard for firms to absorb all at once. And certainly that's one of the consequences of not paying attention to this regulation for a while.
In joining the lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Labor, Wisconsin's Attorney General Brad Schimmel called this rule, quote, a federal overreach. What's your response to that comment?
Well, I think, as a society, we have to make decisions about whether we have things like overtime laws at all. So, we decided in the 1970s that it was important to have an overtime provision and to try to protect workers from, potentially being exploited at some point, or at least, not being compensated at the same level. So we have this law in place, and then we didn't pay a lot of attention to it over time. We didn't sort of index it with inflation. So, it's a question of whether do we want an overtime regulation or not, and if we do, how do we implement it? And it seems like it's the implementation that's causing some problems right now, where people are struggling with how quickly should we implement it, who should be covered, and how should we change that coverage over time.
So this change was announced in May. It's taking effect in December. Here we are more than halfway through September, and Wisconsin and these other 21 states are filing suit. Is it likely to change anything before this would actually go in place in December?
It's hard for me to say. I'm an attorney. I don't know how quickly some of these cases will move forward. I think certainly many employers are proceeding as if it will be in place, and they're putting into place policies and procedures to either provide the overtime or to prevent people from being in a position where they're asked to work those overtime hours. There are some bills pending and some proposals that the politicians have made to implement this more slowly and give firms and the states and other employers more time to implement it. I do think the fundamental driver of this is that there's a lot of concern in policy circles about whether working families' incomes are keeping up. And so, much like the debate over the minimum wage and other kinds of policies that are out there, this is one of those tools that some policymakers are looking at as a way to try to boost the wages of people in the sort of working families.
And as we wrap up, Michael, 22 states, as we've said, almost half of the states have joined in this lawsuit. What do you think is at the heart of the opposition to this change in the unemployment law?
Well, perhaps there's some who just don't believe we should have an unemployment law at all, or I'm sorry, of an overtime law at all. You know, there shouldn't be any additional pay for people who are asked to work over some amount of hours per week. You know, I think most people do think that there is some need for some overtime protection. And then it comes down to, you know, how quickly we need to implement this. And, you know, is $47,500 the right level, or should it be $35,000 or some other level? And, you know, I think that's really a matter of who's affected and how much it's going to cost them to implement it and that kind of thing. So, you know, like I said, I think by and large we think that the policy is the right policy, but, you know, there's a lot of debate over whether this is too much too fast in terms of how it's being implemented.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was J. Michael Collins, Faculty Director of the Center for Financial Security at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the news that Wisconsin is joining a lawsuit challenging the U.S. Department of Labor over a rule that would expand who's eligible for overtime pay.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, for a lot of people, what they do for a living is a core part of their identity. We learn how unemployment might not just affect your finances, but also your perception of yourself.
First, we're less than 50 days away from the general election, and the polls are showing that the field is narrowing between Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton and Republican nominee Donald Trump.
It's also rumored that a former U.S. president will reach across the aisle and vote for a candidate of the opposite party. And New Jersey's Chris Christie is in hot water following an investigation into the bridge closing scandal in his state.
Joining us now to talk about the latest from the campaign trail is Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So things a little closer to Election Day, a little closer to the debates. And what do we know about the polls today?
Well, thank goodness we're a little bit closer to everything being over. But essentially what we see is that Hillary Clinton still holds a lead, but it's a lead that's been shrinking, especially over the last few weeks since that health scare, although that might not have been exactly what caused it. We've seen Clinton's lead continuing to shrink since her post-convention high. And right now, we only have Clinton at about a 57% chance to win the election. She leads by a little less than 2 points nationally, although she is still the nominal favorite over Donald Trump.
Is that 57% you got today, is that the lowest she's been?
That is amongst the lowest that she has been. If you look at our Polls Plus model, which basically takes into account economic measures and takes into account convention balances, it is about the lowest it's been. If you look at only the polls, it's close to, but she was a little bit lower after Donald Trump's Republican National Convention.
Now, your boss, Nate Silver, had a piece recently on 538.com about how the expanding and contracting of these numbers is cyclical, and it's not something that we should get too invested in. He said the media follows a particular story, which might be Trump catching up. Then they lose interest, and they follow the other one, Clinton moving ahead, and that sort of feeds into this. Do you agree with him?
I mean, I generally do agree with him. You know, these are two candidates who the more focus it seems to be that's on a particular candidate at a particular time, the worse they do in the polls. I've argued that what you really want this election to be about is the other candidate because they're both historically unpopular. But we should point out that after the Clinton health scare, there was a lot of focus on her, but then there was focus more on Donald Trump, especially after he denied that he no longer believes that President Obama is born in the United States. Now, he says he believes that there was a lot of focus on him, but in fact, what we've seen over the past 24 hours is that although there have been some good polls for Hillary Clinton, for instance, in New Hampshire, where she was up by nearly 10 percentage points, if you look at all of the polls and compare them to the prior poll from those pollsters, we in fact see that Clinton has continued to have a slight decline. So we'll have to wait and see. Obviously, this could all be moot come the debates if one of the candidates puts in a stellar performance.
Now, you mentioned a New Hampshire poll. What's happening there?
Well, if you were to put together a map for Hillary Clinton, that's sort of the base map that she needs to win this election, there are basically a few states where she needs to hold on to. One of them is Wisconsin, one of them is Colorado, one of them is Virginia, and the other big one is New Hampshire. Although it has only four electoral votes, it's what basically takes her from a 268, which would be losing because you need 270 to win. You add those four to the 268, and you get her to 272. And what we have seen in New Hampshire is that Donald Trump has not led in a single poll that calls cell phones in that state, which is pretty good for Clinton, including today's Monmouth University poll, which had her up by nearly 10 percentage points. But there are other ways that Donald Trump could stop Hillary Clinton from getting the 270, but it seems increasingly likely, at least to me, that New Hampshire might not be the way to go for him.
And what about Wisconsin? We just had a Marquette poll released today. Did you see anything that surprised you there?
No. I mean, I guess maybe the only thing that was kind of a little surprising was, you know, if you look at the likely voter results among the four-way, that is including Johnson and Stein, you see that it's the same race that it was at the end of August. So that is a rare poll, which basically says that the races stay basically the same. But, you know, remember, Donald Trump was way down in Wisconsin at the beginning of the cycle, way down, especially after he lost the Wisconsin primary. He has climbed back. He is close to Clinton. She still leads. But if Donald Trump can get the same percentage of Republicans on his side that Hillary Clinton has of self-identified Democrats on her side, he has a real shot of winning that state. And if he wins in Wisconsin, you can build a map for Clinton in which she wins the election, but it becomes increasingly difficult very, very quickly.
Harry Enten's with us right now. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538, talking about the latest in the race for the White House. And this week, Harry, on this show, we've been talking about millennials and how millennial voters, young voters, don't seem particularly into either candidate. Is that worse news, do you think, for the Clinton camp or the Trump camp?
Now, I would argue it's worse news for the Clinton camp. You know, if you look at the election 4 years ago, we know that Barack Obama, according to the American National Election Studies, won those under the age of 25 by nearly 30 percentage points. According to data that was recently released by SurveyMonkey to 538, which is where I work, obviously, that lead that Hillary Clinton had among those under the age of 25 is only 13 percentage points, so nearly a third less, or, you know, only about a third as much as it was for Obama 4 years ago. And if Clinton actually had the same margin that Obama had or has the same margin that would basically match how they feel, 18 to 24-year-olds, how they feel about President Obama currently, if it matched that, her lead would go up by about 2 percentage points. So to me, it's Clinton who's underperforming. Trump is doing about what you'd expect. And so the idea that millennials don't like either candidate is far worse news for Hillary Clinton.
And what about the third-party candidates who are in this race? Do you expect them to tip the race in either direction?
If they tip in either direction and you take all of the polls into account in all of the states, it would suggest that the third-party candidates at this point are taking more votes away from Hillary Clinton than from Donald Trump. It's only about a point on the margin, so Clinton's lead decreases, say, from 3-2. But in a race that is close, it could make the difference.
Now, we mentioned the debates. The debates are just around the corner, and this could be, I mean, it seems to me that usually we talk a lot about the debates, we hype them up a lot, and then they don't change things very much. But do you think that could be different this time because this race is so unusual? Could the debates really be kind of a seismic activity going on?
Well, it could be one of two things, right? It doesn't even need to be seismic. Because we're within 2 percentage points, we have seen debates change the polls by upwards of 4 percentage points on average. If you remember in 2000, for instance, Al Gore had a slight lead heading into the debates, and then it was George W. Bush who held a slight lead going out of the debates, and although it was a very, very close race at the end, Bush ended up winning. So even if we had a slight change, it could make the difference, especially if it tips the balance towards Donald Trump. As to the fact that this could be a larger bounce than usual, it could be, if only because there are a lot more undecided than usual. And if they're tuning into the debates, or even if they're not and they're just reading and watching the post-debate spin, it could definitely tip the balance more so than usual.
What are you expecting from them? Are you expecting to see a different Donald Trump than we've seen, one who's more disciplined or anything different from Hillary Clinton?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump could always surprise us, although I've thought that we were going to see a different Donald Trump on many other occasions before, and it was the same old Donald Trump, though he's managed, for the most part, to keep it together over the past few weeks. But I don't expect that Donald Trump is all of a sudden going to be a policy wonk. In terms of Hillary Clinton, I think, look, if you look back at Hillary Clinton's past debate performances, she's always exceedingly well-prepared. It's going to be very interesting. What I'd like to see is whether Donald Trump continues to make statements that most fact-checkers across this country deem are false, and whether Hillary Clinton, if the moderators don't jump in, whether Hillary Clinton will jump in and try and describe them as false right off the bat.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch and see if that tips the needle in either direction. And you mentioned the name Bush. Well, there was another Bush who made news this week. Former President George H.W. Bush, saying that he's actually going to be voting for Hillary Clinton. What do you make of that news?
Well, you know, if you look and you're trying to figure out who are the Republicans that have been abandoning Donald Trump, and we should point out that more Republicans say they'll vote for Hillary Clinton than Democrats currently say they're going to vote for Donald Trump, at least in the overall poll aggregate. If you look at the Republicans who say that they're not going to vote for Donald Trump, they tend to be a little bit more moderate, they tend to be from the Northeast, and they tend to be well-educated. Well, George H.W. Bush is originally from the Northeast. Now, obviously, he resides in Texas, but he's originally from the Northeast. He went to Yale, and compared to the Republican Party of today, he's pretty moderate. So to me, it's not too surprising that George H.W. Bush is getting behind Hillary Clinton. The question, of course, going forward is whether or not it means anything. My guess is it probably doesn't. I don't think most people are sitting at home going, I wonder what the president who was president 20 years ago said. I think it's more of an indication of the types of people who are abandoning Donald Trump, and the ones that are look a lot like George H.W. Bush. So it shouldn't be too surprising to me in the polls that we continue to see that Trump is struggling amongst Republicans compared to Hillary Clinton amongst Democrats.
Now, someone who's not abandoning Donald Trump is Chris Christie, and we've had this news that an investigation found he did know about the bridge closure seen as retaliation. What is your take on what's going on with Chris Christie and Donald Trump?
He hasn't been on the campaign trail too much for Chris Christie that much recently. Too much on the campaign trail for Donald Trump that much recently. Donald Trump, there was always that old joke that, you know, Chris Christie was basically his shoe shiner in a way, dating back to the old joke from Goodfellas. But, to me, Chris Christie would be basically lucky. He has no real future in politics. There was some talk that he might be the attorney general for Donald Trump if Trump won the presidency. That, to me, seems increasingly unlikely. I think Christie will be lucky to get out of this without spending any time in jail, because it seems to me that people had always thought that he probably knew something, they just couldn't prove it. And the news that came out this week probably indicates that, in fact, that belief was true, that he did know something about those bridge closings. And I guess Republicans got lucky that Trump is their nominee instead of Christie, who, if they had found that out right now, I don't even want to know what would be happening on a campaign trail with the presidential candidate, you know, in Christie's position.
Interesting times. Well, Harry, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Have a good one.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, and he's with us every week to give us the latest in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we talk about how losing a job affects more than just your finances. It can also influence your identity and mental health. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin tells us about a proposed bill that would address price hikes for essential prescription drugs.
First, losing a job can be scary. And in the midst of the Great Recession, plenty of Americans were struggling with unemployment and covering the cost of living. According to our next guest, money isn't the only thing that becomes a top concern after a job loss. One of the biggest challenges that can come with unemployment is a challenge to your identity and how you see your role in the world.
Joining us now is Dawn R. Norris. She's an assistant professor of sociology at UW La Crosse, and her recent book is called Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health. Dawn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So in your book, you look at identity and mental health problems that can be related to unemployment. Can you take us through what happens when a person loses their job?
Well, a variety of things can happen, and some of them actually occur prior to losing one's job. One of the things that happens is that people don't feel like they are the same person anymore. That sense of stability of who they are starts to crumble when they no longer have their jobs. In the U.S., who we are is largely based on what we do for a living. One of the first things that people ask us is, what do you do? And we have multiple identities, multiple roles, but a big piece of that is our job. When we lose that sense of stability and we become confused about who we are. One of the most harmful things that can happen, that can harm our mental health, is that loss of identity.
And talking about that term identity, we throw that word around a lot, but in terms of your job, what other words can you use for that? Is part of it a sense of status?
It can be. A sense of prestige is part of it. It can be a sense of who you are, let's say, as a man, For example, men often feel like their job makes them the breadwinner, mm-hmm. and that's a very important thing to many men. In sociology, we tend to think of having multiple identities. There's not just one. We have many identities, and they're often based on our roles, our positions in society, things like being a parent or an author or an athlete or an employee.
And something you focus on in your book is identity mismatches that can happen after job loss. What do you mean by that?
This is when the meaning of one of your identities tends to conflict with the meaning of another identity. So, for example, if the meaning of man is breadwinner and you lose your job, all of a sudden the meaning of unemployed doesn't match with man, and you start to have mental health issues.
And what other emotional challenges can happen when there's that kind of a mismatch? Is part of that going from feeling useful and like you're doing something worthwhile for those 8 or 9 hours a day, and then all of a sudden there's that void?
That's certainly one part of it. What my book focused on went beyond that, that people talked about not being the same person anymore or not getting feedback from other people that they were who they thought they were. For example, one of the people in my book named, I call her Cindy, she's a 62-year-old award-winning account executive in the travel industry. And after the Great Recession, or during the Great Recession, mergers happened. Companies were trying to desperately gain that profit margin and succeed. The merger occurred with the travel company she worked for. And as a result of that merger, they laid many people off, and she was kept on, but she got a new boss. This new boss was younger than her by a couple of decades. And as she was positioned into the new role, her age became a focus for her. She felt that her age of 62 did not match what was expected in the company because she was surrounded by younger people. Additionally, this new younger boss kept telling her, well, you just don't get it. I just don't know why you're just not getting it. Hmm. And eventually she was so concerned that she was having some form of dementia that she went to get tested. She went to a psychologist to be tested to see if she had dementia. She did not. In fact, the requirements they were putting on her were so severe that she found out after she left her job, after she lost her job, she found out that other people were fudging their numbers, that nobody could achieve the requirements that this new boss had put on them. Nevertheless, she interpreted this as being about her age, that her age didn't match her job. And I heard this echoed through several participants.
Are there particular fields where you think there is more of a risk of when there is a loss of employment that the people who are now unemployed have more serious challenges with identity and mental health issues? Do you see some sectors where that's more prevalent?
I think it would depend on a number of things. That's a good question. I think that in the tech industry, if you're a little bit older, for example, I have a brother-in-law who is in his 40s and he works for a tech company. He sometimes talks about being the old guy around, and that you know, that mismatch might be there for him. Beyond that, you know, I think that certainly white-collar jobs, people are training for many, many years to be able to get into those positions, whether it's a college degree or professional training. And when you've put so much of your life into, the length of your life into a job, it can become an even stronger part of your identity. That being said, I wouldn't say that working class jobs don't bring a sense of identity. I think they do, but in a different way.
We're talking with Dawn Norris. She's an assistant professor of sociology at UW La Crosse, and we're discussing her recent book, which is Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health. Now, I wonder, Dawn, if it's something that you got a chance to look at in your research. I can see that if you've been in a career for a long time, that's a big part of your identity, but does it change at all if you've kind of hopped from job to job, or if you've been in one company and lose that company and all the people that come with it? Is that an even more severe loss to deal with?
I think if you are not in one particular position for a long time, it actually makes it easier. the longer we're in a particular role, such as a job, the more ingrained it becomes for who we are. We enact that job every day. We enact that role every day. We act with other people every day who give us feedback that we are the person we think we are. So if you're hopping around from job to job, that might be very disorienting. It might make you feel very unstable and harm your mental health in those ways. But it probably would not harm your identity as much as being in a job for a long time.
So maybe in some ways, if you've moved around a lot, if your career has been a little more dynamic or has had changes kind of a constant to it, maybe you've developed some different skills for dealing with what is a very significant change going from employed to unemployed.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a more flexible batch of skills, a more flexible identity, you can quickly make these shifts, which is one of the strategies I describe in my book, that can help.
And you've done research with middle class people specifically who lost their jobs. What did you hear from them about what their biggest concerns were when they lost their employment?
Well, one of the things I expected to hear was that they were frightened about their finances, but that was not the number one thing. In fact, most of them didn't mention their financial status at all. They independently brought up that their identity, who they were, was threatened. One of the biggest factors was for men. Again, they described themselves in ways that were very negative. They said, oh gosh, society's going to think I'm a slug. Or they described themselves as being impotent. There was some very gendered language being used there. They were very, very afraid, very scared of what society would think of them and what, for many of them, their wives would think of them. So who they were, how they would become that person again that they once were, their selves were really at risk here.
Do you have a sense of how people that fall on either side of the middle class, so higher earners and lower economic status people, how that differs for those groups?
I would suspect, and again, I haven't done research on the working class or lower income earners. I'd love to do that in the future. I think it might look a little different. For one, when your financial status is the most important thing, and you know, when you're working class or earning low income, you just don't have that buffer. So losing your job, the very first thing you're going to think is, oh my gosh, I don't have a job. How am I going to pay my bills? How am I going to feed my kids? Nevertheless, your identity still comes into play, I think, a little bit differently. For example, hey, I was always a union man and now I'm not. Or hey, I'm, you know, me and these women at this diner, we're servers, we're waitresses, we're a group, we're together, and oh my gosh, now we're not. So it might look a little bit different, and the financial concerns might come to the surface more.
We're talking with Dawn Norris, assistant professor of sociology at UW-La Crosse, about her studies of how job loss affects mental health and senses of identity.
And we want to hear from you. Did leaving a job impact your mental or your emotional health? Did it influence how you saw yourself and your role in life? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can tell us if your job and what you do for a living is a big part of your identity. Call 800-642-1234.
And we continue this conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up the conversation with Dawn Norris, assistant professor of sociology at UW-La Crosse. And we're talking about how losing a job can impact identity and mental health.
And we want to hear from you. Has leaving a job ever impacted your relationships, either at home or with your friends? Were you one of the many people that lost their job during the Great Recession? And if so, how did you cope with that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you had to rebuild your identity or learn to see yourself differently after becoming unemployed. Or maybe did losing your job end up being a good thing in the long run? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, we just asked people, Dawn, about how it might have affected relationships. And you've touched a little bit on the relationship with a spouse, especially for a man who might really identify as being a breadwinner. What do you see in women who lose their jobs and how that might affect their relationship with their family?
It really varies. Some of them went through separations because of the stress on their own identities, and as well as some of the economic stress. Women in general, I found, were a little bit more resilient. And one of the reasons was that some of them felt they could, what I call, shift to a different identity. Many of them shifted to emphasize the mother identity. So, for example, a 41-year-old chief financial officer, who I'll call Charlotte, had told me that throughout her life, she had seen herself as the breadwinner, and she was the sole breadwinner for her family of three. Her husband was a stay-at-home father, and he took care of their two young children. She said, "Thank God I have this set up where my husband takes care of the kids, because if it were me, it would be really messed up." Always saw herself as an employee, and then she lost her job. And it was very stressful for her. She said she didn't know who she was anymore. But within a matter of a few months, she had shifted her emphasis to say, you know what, I'm a really good mother. And you know what, if I have a bad day, I can just make egg cartons, caterpillars out of egg cartons, I think is what she said. And I can be super mom. And her whole attitude had shifted. Women were able to do this a lot better than men. Mm-hmm. When men described trying to shift to a father role, and many of them tried, they tried to say, I'll just be a father. They said, well, anybody can be a father. So one man even described it, well, to be a father, you just need to be a sperm donor.
I'm thinking, as you're talking about how people transition to retirement, and for some people it can be a very difficult transition because their identity has been their working life for so long. But I'm wondering if you see a difference between assuming that retirement is chosen or at least planned for or at least anticipated, if there's a difference between that and losing your job.
Absolutely. The voluntary or involuntary nature of any transition like this makes a big difference. When we choose to do something, first of all, we have control. And control over our circumstances is one of the most important factors for mental health as well. But certainly when it comes to jobs, if it's involuntary, we don't have time to prepare for how will we handle this new circumstance? Who will I become now? And if you don't have that time to prepare, you're thrown into it. You can fall into what I call identity void, this loss of all sense of self. One of the people I spoke to described that as being like you're dead and nobody told you.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones and bring on Mark, who's in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. I hope you can hear me.
Yes,
okay,
it's fine.
I'm calling from Duluth. I just want to know if you've read anything by Eckhart Tolle, and he makes a point that we see ourselves too much in what we do and our accomplishments rather than just being and who we are.
Thanks for that call, Mark. Dawn?
I have not read that, but I have read some other authors who are making the same argument. And, you know, part of the problem here is that we do live in a culture that emphasizes work and making money and what we do. And it's really, really hard to de-emphasize that when you don't have the support of your culture. Certainly there's some work on Israel, for example, Ofer Sharon's work on Israeli people who have lost their jobs and are seeking work. They're not putting quite as much emphasis on the job as who they are. It's just their batch of skills. And I think sometimes in the U.S. we put so much emphasis on it. We put all our eggs in one basket, and then when it goes, it goes, and we're left without a balanced identity.
Thanks for that call, Mark. Let's go now to Barbara in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, yes. I am 67 years old. I work 40 hours a week as a professional buyer. I've been doing this work for 20, 25 years, and I've been through job losses about three times in the last, since 2002. Mm-hmm. The first time it happened, I had a high school senior that I was providing health insurance for, and I was scared out of my mind. But at the last minute, they decided that, no, they needed to keep me, and I was on a roller coaster ride. I didn't know what felt worse, losing the job or getting the job back.
Mm, yeah.
And then the second time was in 2008, and that time I was prepared for it. I had already secured other employment, and it was a breeze until that company went through a restructuring, and I was let go again. And at that time, my son had left. I had an empty nest. I had no husband, and I was devastated again. But I went back to school, and I got my skills all updated, and now I'm so happily employed, I can't tell you. I don't even know when I'm going to retire.
Well, thanks so much for that, Barbara, and I want to give Dawn a chance to respond. It sounds like Barbara has kind of built in some resiliency.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds that way. Being prepared, she mentioned, helped her get through that second period of job loss, going back to school and kind of restructuring who she is in some ways. You know, it's interesting because some of the research actually shows that worrying about losing a job can be harder on your physical and mental health than actually losing your job sometime. That uncertainty, you know, at least if you've lost your job, you know, okay, I've lost that. Now I need to move forward. So first of all, Barbara, my apologies to hear about the previous job losses, but congratulations on your new job.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Barbara. And let's stay with our callers and go now to Mary in Dane County. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I lost my job when I was about 61. It was during that recession, and I had been there 17 years, and it came out of the blue. I didn't even know it was going to happen. And it was, I still don't think I've recovered. Mm-hmm. And mentally or financially, I just feel like, I don't know, I'm afraid to get a job. Mm-hmm. And that's terrible, but it's how I feel.
So, Mary, you said it's been about 7 years or so, and so you've been unemployed since that happened. Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Dawn, does that echo to things that you heard from other people?
Yeah, absolutely. For one thing, if you're over 40, and certainly if you're over 60, very real age discrimination exists out there. And it makes it very, very hard to move forward and take that chance and put yourself on the line. Several of the people I spoke to talked about trying to put resumes out there and repeatedly just not hearing anything. You know, we're living in a day and age where you don't get a rejection letter, you just hear nothing. It's radio silence. Mm-hmm. And this was really disturbing to them, to the point where they said, I can't do this anymore. I can't put myself on the line anymore.
Before I have to wrap up, I want to make sure we touch on one other aspect. We talked a little bit about the difference for men and women. What about differences between different racial groups? Did you see any difference there?
I did. I spoke with both white and black participants in my study. Black participants overall were more resilient. However, they had some very specific concerns when they would lose their jobs. For one thing, they mentioned that putting themselves on the line was a little bit different in terms of worrying about racial discrimination. For example, worrying that people would think they had lost their job because they'd done something because of their race, or that race would come into the explanation for why they were unemployed, even when that was not the case. Other black participants talked about being worried that if they took a lower-level job, so for example, Janelle was a college-educated online programming manager for a TV station, and she lost her job. She was laid off. It was nothing she did wrong. They were cutting costs. She was offered a job as a product demonstrator at Walmart. You know, the people who hand you some meat mm-hmm. or some product to try, some crackers or some jelly or whatever it might be. And they said, well, the products will vary, but, you know, it's a job. So she was offered this job, and she was really concerned that if she took this job that she would sort of confirm the stereotype. But she was about to also lose her apartment. So she was really in this bind. Overall, they were more resilient, and these participants credited that to their parents. They credited that to thinking about how disadvantaged they could be in comparison to where they were.
And we'll have to leave it there. Don, thank you so much for joining us. That was Dawn R. Norris, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UW La Crosse. She joined us to talk about her book, Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health. And you can keep the conversation going about your experiences on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, this year there's a new teenager around. Starbucks Pumpkin Spice Latte turns 13 years old. To give you an idea of just how successful the drink is, it's got its own nickname, the PSL.
And it also helped popularize the whole pumpkin spice flavor thing, which, by the way, it's a combination of cinnamon and clove, nutmeg, ginger, and sometimes actual pumpkin.
Or perhaps artificial pumpkin flavor.
Well, it seems like it's getting a little out of hand. I love all things pumpkin, but do we really need pumpkin spice hummus?
I would say no, personally. But it is. And also, when everything's kind of the same flavor palette, it just gets kind of boring. But I do love pumpkin things. I love pumpkin bread with dark chocolate chips and pumpkin spice. I'll admit it. What about you, Veronica?
For me, it's pumpkin pancakes. And I've already made them once this season, but I've actually started making them all summer long because I can't wait till fall.
So do you use canned pumpkin?
Canned pumpkin.
I think it's the way to go, really, unless you're a real purist. Well, whatever you like, however you enjoy it, we hope that you're into the pumpkin spice season and that it's delicious.
It's a good time, too. First day of fall coming up tomorrow. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.